Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly status update on the technology business. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones and I'm joined in our makeshift Tent Come studio by the people who write the tech stories on the BBC website. This week, Dave Lee.
Hi there.
And Jane Wakefield.
Hello.
Are back in the tent. And we've a special guest to comment on all our stories today. It's the technologist and social entrepreneur, Mariam Jam. She's the moving spirit behind Africa Gathering, which brings all sorts of tech entrepreneurs together each year. And she's also a consultant to tech companies wanting to set up in Africa. Welcome to the tent, Mariam.
Thank you so much.
Now, first this week, what on earth is happening to the cryptocurrency Bitcoin? Bitcoin believers can point to its increasing adoption as a means of payment. Even this church, St. Martin's Gospel Oak in London, started accepting donations in bitcoins in the past week. And by the way, if you go to our Twitter account, at BBC Tech Tent, you can hear an interview with the vicar of that church in about why he's accepting Bitcoin. But overall, it's got to be said, it's been a dreadful few days for the online currencies. There have been security issues, the biggest exchange has halted withdrawals, there's been talk about criminal use again. Jane Wakefield, give us the headlines and all that.
Yeah, so this is the news that two of the biggest exchanges, Mt. Gox and Bitstamp, have stopped withdrawals due to problems with the underlying software that kind of makes the system work. And obviously this has had a big effect on a currency that's always been quite volatile. And the current price of one Bitcoin is worth around $622. I mean, this is down from a high before Christmas of over $1,000. So it could be a big problem for it.
It is volatile. In fact, we've got that price on a screen behind us in the tent, and I've been watching it go up and down by the minute. So, you know, we'll give you a continuing updates on that. Well, where is the debate on Bitcoin? We've brought together in the tent an enthusiast, Jeremy Bonney from CoinDesk, a news site about digital currencies, and in the sceptical corner, Garrick Harlman from the London School of Economics. Jeremy, first, you must be really worried. This has been the week. The wheels have fallen off the Bitcoin bandwagon, haven't they?
I'm really actually not very worried at all. I mean, if anything, I think this week really shows the resilience of Bitcoin. So we've seen these kind of issues before. I would say probably the bug we haven't seen, you know, in this scale before. But we've seen the hacks and the scams and Silk Road closed down maybe 6 months ago now. And there was a small crash after that, but Bitcoin quickly rebounded.
Garrick Harlman, it's resilient. Whatever the scares of each week, it's getting more and more acceptance.
Well, this is true. It does seem to be gathering acceptance, but still, there's only 3,000 merchants in the entire world that accept Bitcoin. That's a really, really small number, a small handful in London even. So there's not very many places where you can currently spend your Bitcoins. It's really more of a speculative financial asset than it is a medium of exchange.
Yeah, I can't go out and buy a sandwich with it, although I did manage once to buy a pizza with it. But it was an incredibly complex business.
There's, I think, a handful of places in London, a pub, a taco stand maybe, just a couple businesses that take it, but not too many.
Jeremy, though, that's the problem, isn't it? It's very popular amongst a very devoted community who see it in almost religious terms. But it's not got widespread acceptance. It's not going to have widespread acceptance, and it's going to be incredibly volatile until you can actually use it to spend on just about anything.
I mean, I think a lot of the best technologies started off quite niche. You know, when PayPal first started, you know, there weren't millions and millions of merchants accepting it. It was a slow ramp up to that. But, you know, often there are tipping points along the way. I think one of the big tipping points is probably coming this year. So one of the major retailers accepting Bitcoin is called Overstock.com. And they recently announced they've taken $1 million in Bitcoin sales so far. So I think we'll see more of that this year.
But when an exchange won't let you take your money out, it's like a bank failing, isn't it? I mean, that is a huge issue, surely.
Well, again, this is where I think it's been resilience. So some of these issues have now been fixed. And as of today, Bitstamp are reinstating Bitcoin withdrawals.
Garrick, you look at all sorts of currencies. I mean, historically, you're an economic historian. What makes you more skeptical about this than other currencies that have come and gone?
Well, my research on alternative currencies over the last 500 years is brought to light several important things. One is that they tend to fail relatively quickly after they're introduced. There's some socioeconomic need, which drives an introduction. It's not surprising to see a proliferation in alternative currencies since the 2008 financial crisis. That's happened previously during the Great Depression, even before that. And they really tend to fail for three reasons. One, they get regulated out of existence. Policymakers, nation states don't like alternative currencies. Two, some kind of technological innovation comes around, and Bitcoin certainly has technical competitors. They're innovating in interesting ways. But really the main reason, Rory, that these currencies tend to fail is that there's just simply a lack of demand for them after whatever short-run crisis has led to their introduction abates.
Garrick Hallman and Jeremy Bonney, thank you very much. Mariam Jam in the tent with us with an African view. Are you an enthusiast about Bitcoin? Is it going to take place? Is it going to take off in countries like Nigeria, Uganda, Ghana?
I think it may take off in Kenya, because Kenya is always the benchmark of everything. And I think that it may take that. I think I can see that. I can see it working with alongside the M-Pesa system. So
that mobile currency has actually, that's been the big hit, not Bitcoin, isn't it?
Exactly. So I think that if we can just add on Bitcoin on it, it might work very well. But you need to work in the West first.
Yeah. But funnily enough, there's more openness to innovation in some ways in money in Africa than in other places.
Exactly. I mean, M-Pesa is like working, is changing lives. You know, when I go to Nairobi, for example, I don't use cash. I just use my M-Pesa point. So,
You don't need Bitcoin at the moment. Great. Great. Well, it's now time for our roundup of the other big stories from the technology industry. Dave Lee, a deal this morning saw Rakuten buy Viber for $900 million. Now, many people would have heard of neither of them, but this deal does tell us a lot about what's going on in tech, doesn't it?
Yeah, Rakuten's a Japanese company, and Viber is a product, an app that's very much like WhatsApp, the popular instant messaging service that uses data to allow people to send text messages, pictures, and even make kind of calls over the internet as well. It's very, very popular. That $900 million deal works at about $3 per user, just under $3 per user. So it's a big acquisition, but they described it as a no-brainer.
And Rakuten, which this ever bigger Japanese company, it's been spending a lot lately, hasn't it?
They have. They have a few big companies on their books now. Kobo, the ebook company that makes devices and sells books, they own them. And they're also a major investor in the picture-sharing network Pinterest.
So they're really a company to watch out for. The other interesting thing that struck me is that Viber is another Israeli technology firm that's bursting onto the world scene and making a lot of money for people in Israel. Jane Wakefield, you've been looking at the intersection of tech and the fashion business.
Yes, well, today sees the opening of London Fashion Week, as I'm sure you're aware, Rory. You'll be at the front of the catwalk, scribbling down notes for your style next year. But I came across some interesting technology in the form of a handbag that's programmable and basically locked if it thinks you're spending too much money. Some people might think this is a fantastic idea. Other people might not be so sure. It's the brainchild of an Australian credit card comparison site. And earlier this week, I spoke to Michelle Hutchinson, who explained how it works.
Firstly, there's an RFID tag that's sewn into the bag, and you put one tag inside your wallet and it records every time you take out your wallet. There's also a GPS chip, and that also tracks you're spending. All that information is logged into software that you can download heat maps and graphs that show you your spending patterns. And then you basically use that information to determine when your bad spending habits are, and you program the bag to lock at certain times of the day and also in your danger spending zone.
So a high-tech handbag. Mariam, that sounds pretty daft, doesn't it?
I mean, I can just imagine a Nigerian lady just kind of like refusing to buy the bag, you know, because they like spending millions and millions of pounds. So,
Dave Lee, you've also got a warning from the man who invented GPS this week.
Yes, indeed. So people are increasingly using illegal jamming devices to jam GPS to hide their own positions. And experts are now worried that the technology is now so powerful and so cheap that it's posing a serious risk to those who rely on GPS to operate safely. Earlier this week, I spoke to Colonel Brad Parkinson, who was part of the team that invented GPS back in the 70s. And he explained to me the scale of the problem and what he thinks should happen to those responsible for the jamming.
Many Ships have GPS, but the systems were not designed to be jam resistant or spoof resistant. And as a result, you have these test results that show suddenly they are hundreds of miles away from their current location. What I'm advocating is that the illegal use of those be prosecuted and that those devices be located and confiscated and the people put in jail.
So a big concern there. Dave, what's the solution?
So Brad Parkinson is advising that governments put their hands in their wallets, really, and invest in the use of a system known as ELORAN, which is a kind of GPS alternative that uses radio waves rather than satellites.
GPS changing? I mean, we're all completely dedicated to it. We all, more and more people run their lives via those services.
Well, one of the things that Brad Parkinson said, he was worried that people are losing the ability to read normal maps because of his invention. So it is changing how we operate.
And finally, the American investment bank Goldman Sachs found itself in hot water again this week at an undergraduate student event held last week at Harvard University to encourage women coders. They apparently supplied corporate branded cosmetic mirrors and nail files for the goodie bags given to the attendees. They later apologised. We're strong supporters of efforts to recruit and retain women in technology. We apologised if the gifts gave anyone offence, a spokeswoman told the New York Times. Well, whoops. Mariam and Jane, would you have been offended by that, Jane?
I think it's not really sending out the greatest of messages, is it? Let's be honest, you know. I think that there's a really big image problem with women in technology anyway, and things like this are just not going to help.
Mariam?
That's a complete bribery, in my view.
So not impressed by Goldman Sachs. You're listening to Tech Tent, the weekly look at business and technology on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catherine-Jones. Find us on Twitter at BBC Tech Tent. Now, new doubts about just how well Facebook works as an advertising platform have been raised this week. It's a story which I first investigated in 2012 when I set up an imaginary business on the social network and bought some ads to promote it. It's a local business in West London. Its description: we send you bagels via the internet, just download and enjoy. We have a dream to deliver. So that was Virtual Bagel in 2012. It was a huge success. Over 3,000 people registered a Facebook like for it. Now, I found that most of them were from countries like India and Egypt, where it's known that so-called click farms operate. These are places where people are paid a tiny sum to click on and like just about anything. So my ads hadn't exactly bought me quality customers. But this week, the science blogger Dr. Derek Muller followed up that investigation in a film which has had more than a million views on his Veritasium YouTube channel. He set up Virtual Cat, another meaningless business, but this one targeted only at America, Canada, Australia and the UK. And he found he still got likes very quickly. But there was something strange about the people who did like Virtual Cat.
All of the profiles were from the places I had targeted, mostly the US, but there was something strange about them. All of these people liked a lot of things, like hundreds and thousands of things. And a lot of the things they liked were odd, too. Like, in one account, this person liked T-Mobile, AT&T, and Verizon. They liked Jeep, and Lexus, and Mercedes, and Volvo, and Volkswagen. They liked everything. Other accounts I saw, they liked kitchen scrubbers, and they liked mouthwash. Who reports that on their Facebook page? It baffles me.
So a taste of Derek Muller's video there. And last night I spoke to him and asked him why he was so convinced that the people who liked his virtual cat were fakes.
I think there's clear evidence that shows that these are not real likes. The average number of pages that someone likes on Facebook is about 40. That's the global average. In the United States, it's a bit more. It's 70. But in most countries, it's in fact less than 20. Now, when I looked at the people who would like Virtual Cat, for example, and I had to spot check them just randomly to have a look at their profiles, they all liked on the order of 1,000 things. So high numbers of hundreds into the thousands.
And I searched all of my friends. I can't find any friend who likes more than 250 pages. Some people have tweeted me and say they like 400. But really, once you start liking up into the thousands, that does not seem like genuine human behavior based on the statistics we have. So, you know, the fact that you have all of these accounts with thousands and thousands of likes, liking pages which are nonsensical, is, I think, clear evidence there is something not genuine going on here.
There are companies that believe in Facebook as a great place to advertise, and Facebook's doing very well out of advertising. Are you saying that it isn't a great place to advertise and the business model is effectively flawed?
You know, I'm saying that I think it is possible for people to succeed on Facebook. I think it's possible for Facebook to be a revenue-generating platform for some businesses, and I think clearly people are demonstrating that. But I also think that that does not nullify the argument that perhaps a high percentage of the likes which are currently happening on Facebook and perhaps a significant fraction of the revenue that Facebook is generating may be due to not genuine likes. You know, I think if you organically grow a page and you never pay to promote your post or pay to promote your page, that seems to be the best model that you can do on Facebook. But as soon as you start paying to spread things around, I think you become an easy target for click farms who are looking to diversify their likes. So they just click on whatever you've got there, and then you're basically wasting money.
So Derek Muller there. And just to explain why you might care if your likes were fake, it's because fake people don't engage, to use the jargon, with your Facebook posts. And posts with low engagement don't then get spread further by the Facebook algorithm, which determines what appears in the newsfeed. So it could be a complete waste of money for you. Well, I contacted Facebook for comment, and they say my virtual bagel ads were poorly targeted, and Derek's cat ad was for a poorly designed page. Facebook told me he created a low-quality page about something a lot of people like, cats. He spent $10 and got 150 people who liked cats to like the page. They may also like a lot of other pages, which does not mean that they are not real people. Lots of real people like lots of things. So that's Facebook's response. It has to be said, though, that those people liked an enormous number of things, thousands upon thousands of things. Anyway, in countries like the US and UK, it's easy to take online shopping for granted. After all, in Britain, internet commerce surged to record levels over this past Christmas holiday period. But there are plenty of countries where the sheer logistics of setting up an e-commerce operation are pretty challenging. I sat down with our reporter Nkem Ifejika, who's been speaking to the chief executive of Nigerian online supermarket Glue.ng, currently serving shoppers in Lagos, but with big hopes to expand across the country. Nkem told me what Olamide Olasanya believes are the particular challenges of online retailing in Nigeria.
One of the main things we've got to think about is online payments. And you've got one of those emails before, I'm a Nigerian prince, and if you just give me your credit card details, I'll deposit some money into you. So there's a distrust of electronic payments also in Nigeria. And that's what Olamide Olusanya of Glue NG was explaining to me.
Payments is still a big challenge in terms of e-commerce or even trading in Nigeria. So you still have a scenario where, based on the experience of customers with fraud about 4 or 5 years ago with magnetic stripe cards before Nigeria did a full chip and pin conversion, you still have that legacy distrust of electronic payments. So basically, cash on delivery is just a way of allaying the fears of potential customers that they can make these purchases without necessarily wanting to put their cards online. And then at the point where they're going to be doing the deliveries, they can either pay with cash or actually swipe their card.
So online payments, one issue. There were other logistical problems though, weren't there?
Well, of course, because you've got to build your own logistics business as well. So you don't just figure out how to get the people to come online and buy your stuff, but you've got to build your own maps. You've got to get your own trucks. You can't just give all that stuff to someone else to do for you.
So that's the challenge from the retailer's point of view. But what about the customers?
I mean, the truth is Nigerians like to feel their produce, especially if you're going to be talking about groceries. You want to be able to touch it, but you also want to be able to haggle and say, you know what, I'm not going to pay that much for it. I'll pay half of it. But that's one of the things which Olamide was explaining to me, that retailers becoming more formalized. There are more big retailers. Even open markets are becoming formalized and people get used to the concept of set prices.
If you look at what is happening now, there's a growing what I call formal retail in Nigeria. Okay, so you have a significant investment from your brick and mortars coming in from
mostly
South African,
aren't they? Yes.
South African.
Because ShopRite, Spa, those are the big South African supermarkets.
So you go into those places now, and you pretty have maybe like a handful of these malls spread all over Nigeria now. And the government themselves are pretty much trying to formalize even the open markets that you have, trying to put structures around them. So people are already getting used to formal retailing, where you have a price tag there. What you pick is what you pay. And we're already getting used to it. And that exactly is what we see as the potential in that trend happening in terms of customers' perception. Rather than go put in investments in brick and mortar, we can leapfrog that into the future of retail.
So it's a pretty small operation at the moment, from the sound of it, but pretty ambitious at the same time.
Oh, you got to think about it this way. 170 million people in Nigeria, they've all got to eat, right? They have to eat food. And so if you've got a system where you can supply produce to them and supply their groceries to them, then that's potentially huge. I mean, Olumide Olosanya was explaining that two of the biggest brick and mortar supermarkets have less than 1% of the total market. So you can imagine that the ambitions are huge.
2012, Nigerians consumed $3.34 billion worth of supermarket goods. The biggest entity with a market share, brick and mortar, has 0.6% of that market. The next person has 0.3%. This was at 2012. It's a market growing at 5%. So what it means is like the two biggest guys have less than 1% of that huge market. We're not very modest about the aspirations we have. We believe we're at an advantage. It's an open space. It's a wide space. We've learned a lot in the last 2 years of being able to deal with that, and we've seen the successes. So I don't think the pain we've ended up having to go through you shouldn't be taking yourself through so much pain just because of $1 billion. We have bigger aspirations.
It's Olumide Olosanya with a big laugh from Nkem on the end. Nkem, you're just back recently from Nigeria. Give us a wider picture of how much tech entrepreneurship there is there at the moment.
Oh, there's a real buzz around tech entrepreneurship. So you have kids coming out of university or in university building online games, but giving it an African flavor, you know, something which Nigerians can play. You have the Nigerian equivalent of Love Film and what's the American film company?
Of Netflix.
Of Netflix. So you have the Nigerian equivalent, you know, putting Nollywood films online, and, you know, they're doing very good business. And there's a sense now that people are doing things online. They're paying for their school fees online. They're paying for their cable subscription on their mobile phone. So these sorts of things are happening. But of course, there are also challenges. I'll give you an example. There's a company called Busted NG. So you can buy a bus ticket via mobile phone. So what you do is you don't necessarily go online, but you flash them, i.e. you drop call them. So you call the number and they call you back so that you don't spend any money calling them. And once they call you back, they'll say, what ticket do you want? And then they will go out there physically and get the ticket for you. So it's still not automated. In a sense, it's automated, but they've still got people physically doing the stuff. So there are challenges. There are huge infrastructure challenges. It's only going to get better. That's the key thing.
And actually, those huge infrastructure challenges, the technology is going to help get round some of
it. It's going to help get round it. And that's the thing about a market like Nigeria. It's an opportunity. Those challenges are an opportunity for someone to come in there and do things and make a lot of money. And there's a lot of investment from outside there. People looking at Nigeria as, you know, potentially huge investments when it comes to technology. Because there are lots of very educated people, but they're mostly not in Nigeria. Many of them go abroad. So there's a group of people who are moving back there because they see what the potential are. For example, there's one called Waka Now, and what they do is they're the Nigerian equivalent of Expedia, buying your tickets online. And I went and checked, because what usually happens is the prices tend to be more expensive in these emerging markets than if you went and looked onto Expedia or lastminute.com or whatever. But their prices are pretty close to what you'd get in the West. So they've obviously struck some very good deals with the airline companies and with other suppliers. And those are the sorts of things which will make a killing.
Thanks to Nkem there, talking to Olumide Olosanya of Glue NG. Now, Mariam Jam, still with us. What do you make of that? What does that tell us about the advance of technology in Nigeria and across Africa in particular?
I mean, for this particular case, it's still a dream. It's still definitely a dream, e-commerce business in Africa. I mean, in the next 5 years, Africa will see millionaires. Of course, in the next 10 years, we'll have online millionaires, definitely. And I'm definitely looking forward to seeing proper e-commerce sites. But right now, we have a backbone problem. We have infrastructure problem in Africa where, you know, people, and also where there's a deficit of trust. You know, we haven't, the African consumers are not yet educated to buy online. So you've got the middle class African people who, the woman in, you know, at the bank in Nigeria, she would like to buy some stuff, but there will be a trust issue, yeah.
So where are you seeing opportunities for technology entrepreneurs? What kind, you're in touch with all sorts of startups, right, clusters right across Africa. What opportunities are they finding?
I mean, we have the innovation now. We have people developing innovations, but we need to start investing into infrastructure and the backbones right now in the content. That's the biggest issue we have. So we're pushing really for entrepreneurs to start making profit out of the innovation we've been seeing in the last 5 years. They're innovating, so we got innovators, but they're not making money right now. So the e-commerce angle is something that we need to explore in the continent and make millionaires. But unless the government start investing properly, and we all know that, I was just thinking earlier that, infrastructure, we all know that is the backbone of any economy in the world. And right now, our government are not investing into the proper infrastructure for these entrepreneurs and these innovators, these system developers to actually have their businesses on it. Yeah.
And briefly, what's your biggest hope? What kind of companies are your biggest hope for high-tech Africa?
Right now, I need to see, you know, the fashion industry. I need to see the e-commerce industry. I need to see people developing really good apps, for enterprise solutions in the continent to, you know, reduce, corruption and improve good governance and transparency. I need to see the agriculture sector also, you know, being improved in the continent. Yeah.
That's all we have time for this week. So thanks to my guest, Maryam Jammeh, technologist and advisor to tech firms in Africa, and to our very own Dave Lee and Jane Wakefield. Thanks to you for listening to this download edition of Tech Tent. Remember, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at BBC Tech Tent and keep up with all the technology stories at bbc.com/technology. Join us next time for another session inside our Tech Tent.